Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. We're speaking today with Joel Garreau. He's an avid student of culture, values, and change, author of the best-selling Edge City, Life on the New Frontier, and the Nine Nations of North America. He writes for the Washington Post and is a member of the Global Business Network, one of their scenario planners. He's also served as a fellow at George Mason University at the University of California at Berkeley. Welcome, Joel.
Hi.
Now, Joel, the reason you're here today is because you just are coming out with a book called Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Minds and Bodies and What It Means to Be Human, which is a theme that people hear often on this show. Tell us a little bit about the motivation behind what got you interested in writing this book.
Well, I'm not interested in technology as such. I'm really interested in who we are, how we got that way, where we're headed, and what makes us tick. I'm interested in culture and values. But I was noticing, you know, back in the 90s, that there was all the furor over the web and the net, and people were saying that this was either the biggest thing since the printing press or the biggest thing since fire. And I thought, well, where's the evidence that this is true? You know, technology always causes upheavals in society, cultural and political upheavals. And throughout the 90s, I mean, from my perspective as a journalist, it was a real snooze of a decade. The news was all about peace, prosperity, and Monica. So I'm saying, you know, where is the upheaval? Where is the new Marxists? Where is the, October Revolution? And so it was like the dog that didn't bark. And I began to think about this, and I thought, well, now, wait a minute. Maybe the way this works is the 50s, for example, was a snooze of a decade with the Eisenhower administration, and yet it was a time of unprecedented technological change with television and mass-produced suburban houses and ICBMs and television and everything else. And, of course, even though the 50s was a snooze, it was followed by the upheaval of the 60s. And you can see the same pattern back in the 20s, which was enormous change like radio and automobiles and refrigeration and so forth. And yet the 20s was a frivolous decade that was followed by the upheaval of the 30s. So I thought, oh, wait a minute. What happens if this is the way history works? So suppose the 90s was the snooze decade of great technological change, and it's about to be followed in this decade by the great upheaval. What would that look like? And that's what got me started on this book that is now being published called Radical Evolution.
There are four technologies that you're looking at in this book, and those are the ones that you think are going to be creating this next wave of change?
Yeah, one of my first big aha moments was realizing that, you know, this upheaval is not a story about computers any more than Galileo's big discovery was about telescopes. You know, what this is a real change in how we think about who we are as humans. And the reason for that is that you can see four technologies that I call the GRIN technologies. And that means genetics, robotics, information technology, and nanotechnology. And all of them are following a curve of exponential change. You're seeing a curve that goes straight up. The most obvious example of this is in the information technologies with what the techies call Moore's Law. And that's named after Gordon Moore, one of the three founders of Intel, Intel Inside, the guts of the computer. And he observed back in 1965 that since the chip was invented 6 years previous, the number of transistors on a chip was doubling every 12 months, and his very bold prophecy was that that would continue for the next 10 years. Well, as a matter of fact, what you're seeing is the doubling of information power that you can buy for a dollar every 18 months since 1959, and you've never seen a curve of change like that before in all of human history. We're now up to something like the 28th doubling. And a doubling is an amazing thing. It means that each step is as tall as all the previous steps put together. So 27 doublings means an increase of like 100 million times. And not only are you seeing that in information technology, but this is allowing us to do extraordinary things in other fields. Like, for example, there's a new IBM supercomputer called BlueGene L, and it has approximately the firing power of, in raw processing terms, as a human brain. And it, one of its main goals is to figure out how proteins fold in our body. Proteins are the underpinnings of all living things, and they're put together in really complex three-dimensional shapes. And if one of them is bent in the wrong direction, that can yield just profound disease. And so if you know how proteins fold, you're looking at the underpinnings of life. And so the advances in information technology is now causing an exponential increase in genetic technology. And the same thing is true of robotics, by which I mean the increased tight binding between men and machines, the way, you know, cyborgs, if you will, citizen cyborgs, and also nanotechnology, which is this exploding field of the very, very small, putting things together one molecule or one atom at a time. And the significance of all this is not really, again, the gear so much. It's not that I care all that much about the technology. But the bottom line to all this is that all of these technologies are causing us to arrive at a hinge in history. For the first time in hundreds of thousands of years, our technologies are not so much aimed outward at modifying our environment in the fashion of, you know, fire or clothes or agriculture or cities or even airplanes. Increasingly, these exponentially advancing technologies are aimed inward at modifying our minds, memories, metabolisms, personalities, progeny, and possibly our immortal souls. And that's the holy cats story. That's, you know, you're looking, when you start talking about changing what it means to be human, you're looking at one of the great profound changes in history.
Well, you got to the central point of this show. So I'm speaking again with Joel Garreau. He's the author of Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. And you go on from talking about this fundamental challenge that these technologies pose to humanness, human nature, and talk about the three different scenarios, the heaven and the hell scenarios, which are the super optimists and the super pessimists, and then your prevail scenario, which is kind of the muddle through scenario. So tell us who some of the principal proponents are of the heaven and hell, and what heaven and hell looks like, and then we'll talk about your muddle through.
Right. Well, you know, my background is as a journalist. I work for the Washington Post. And so I'm not advocating any particular future as a result of all this. What I'm doing is doing the best I can to lay out scenarios for how this might end and where it might take us. And we're talking about the one thing to make clear is we're talking about what's happening in the next 10 or 20 years. We're certainly talking about in our lifetime. You're looking at a profound change in what it means to be human. And this is, you know, a real no-kidding scenario. This is not some science fiction, pie-in-the-sky futurology. This is the real nuts and bolts of what is in the engineering lab right now, and that can change our minds and memories and metabolisms and personalities. And, you know, what we'll be seeing in the very near future and how we and our children will be changing. And so towards this end of trying to figure out where this is all going to take us on this magic ride, I started talking to people who had been thinking a great deal about this, including you, of course, and they break down basically into three camps. And the first camp is the one that I chose as the poster child for this camp, the heaven scenario, I call it. The poster child is Ray Kurzweil. And Ray is a famous inventor. He invented the first computer that first machine that could read an ordinary book out loud, which became a big breakthrough for the blind. He's a pioneer in artificial intelligence and pattern recognition, and he's been recognized by three presidents. He's a big deal technologist. But that's not what makes him notorious. What makes him notorious is his books in his books, he is basically saying that he's laying out a future that is essentially indistinguishable from the Christian version of heaven. He is looking at this curve of technological change, and he's saying that this is going to be driving human affairs, and that it's all going to be good. That's the heaven scenario. And it's a scenario to be taken seriously, because you know, we are looking at all sorts of advances that would that promise to ban pain, suffering, disease, aging, stupidity, ignorance, ugliness. I mean, the list is quite impressive of the stuff that's right now in the engineering labs, not down the road somewhere. There's a company that's about to go public, Renat Neuroscience, for example, that has got a pain vaccine that apparently works. You take it, and you don't feel acute pain for 30 days. The military is very, very interested in this, obviously. Within 3 years, there should be memory pills on the market. And these, are, I'm sure, are going to be a big commercial boom, bigger than Viagra, because not only do they promise to banish the senior moments of the baby boomers, but it looks like they could easily add 200 points to the SAT scores of the boomers' kids, and we're talking, you know, 3 to 5 years. This is right close that we're talking about this kind of major change, and it's the promise is extraordinary. You know, you're looking at the possibility of genetically individualized medicine with no side effects. That just it's medicine for you. You know, it's Jay's pill, and so this heaven scenario, in which we see extraordinarily great changes in what ails us, is something to be taken seriously, and that's what Ray Kurzweil certainly does. And once, you know, just to bust his chops, I said, so what are you saying, Ray, that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from angels? And he didn't back down an inch. He said, depends what you mean by angels.
He's coming out with a book very shortly called The Singularity is Near.
Right.
And in my book, I talk about the singularitarians as generally folks who believe in a deus ex machina, literally, that they believe that God is going to come out of the machine. There is a quasi-millennial aspect to what they believe.
Right. Well, in interviewing him, I mean, the one thing I was struck by is that I asked him, you know, about you know, does he believe in God? Because it certainly sounded like it. I thought that was a reasonable question to ask, and I said, so Ray, you know, when you meet your maker, what's this image of this God that you're going to meet? And he says, I don't expect to meet my maker. I don't expect to die. And he's serious. He thinks that in the next 20 or 30 years, medical advances will be so great that if you can last that long, if you can last for the next 20 or 30 years, and you have enough money, that you could effectively be immortal. And so, I mean, he's not really talking about touching the face of God. He's talking about us becoming something like godlike, and he's not kidding. And this is a serious, you know, this is a serious guy. He's not a, you know, new age fruitcake. He's a serious technologist, and so his books are based on rationality. So you have to take, you know, even no matter how far out he sounds, he deserves some serious consideration.
I don't know if you read the essay by Francis Fukuyama in Foreign Policy last year where he said transhumanism was the most dangerous idea in the world.
Yeah.
Towards the end of that essay, he said that there was no one he would rather see live forever less than transhumanists, which I took to be rather personal.
Yeah, really.
Calling for my death is a little bit beyond the pale of political debate, but...
Well, Frank is one of the people who I characterize as part of the second group. And okay, if Ray is part of the heaven scenario, then there is the hell scenario. And the hell scenario is eerily similar to the heaven scenario. It starts with the same premises. It observes that we have this curve of technological change and that it's increasing exponentially, and this is no kidding. And that it also basically assumes that technology drives history, just like the heaven scenario does. But in this case, it's the mirror image of the heaven scenario. If the heaven scenario imagines a curve of human history that smoothly goes straight up, the hell scenario is one in which people look at this increasing technology and see a curve that goes straight down. And they don't mess around when they're talking about going straight down. The optimistic view of some of these hell scenario people, the optimistic version, is that we simply wipe out the human race in the next 25 years or so.
Funny that you said that. I just read Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood.
Right.
And basically, I'm going to write a review of this book because it's fascinating as deep ecology porn. I mean, she basically wipes out the entire human race, and it's quite clear that she thinks that's what we deserve.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for some of these people, that's the optimistic scenario. The pessimistic scenario in the hell scenario is we don't just wipe out the entire human race, but that we wipe out the entire biosphere, and we leave this thing just a barren, leave this planet just a barren lump. And the people who are deeply concerned about the hell scenario, who also, I think, deserve to be taken very seriously, have no end of really deeply pessimistic views of how this unprecedented upheaval that we're facing is going to end. My poster boy for that scenario is Bill Joy. Bill is another famed technologist. He is called the Edison of the Internet. He invented half of everything that's important to the Internet right now, it seems. He's the chief scientist of Sun Microsystems. Again, heavy credentials, heavy dude, smart guy, not a hand waver. I mean, he's a grown-up in the room. And the reason he's so pessimistic is that he says, well, look, you look at these GRIN technologies, genetics, robotics, information, and nanotech. He says, and each one of those has the potential for incredible evil. You know, with genetics, you could attack an entire race, for example, if you were to put together a bug that would you know, target only blue-eyed people, for example, or something like that. With robotics, you're talking about machines becoming so increasingly capable that you can imagine that at some point they will view humans as either pests to be getting rid of, or worse yet, pets. And similarly with nanotechnology, there is the gray goo scenario, so-called, and that's one in which tiny, submicroscopic nanobots, you know, tiny robots, just replicate and replicate and replicate and replicate, and they suck up all the energy on the planet, and that's one of the ones in which the biosphere ends. And each of these scenarios are perfectly logical within their own limits, and soon, within the next 20 or 30 years. And the reason that Bill Joy and people like him are so pessimistic, he says these are the weapons of knowledge-enabled, these are knowledge-enabled weapons, and that if we keep on spreading the knowledge of how this works around, he likens it to giving everybody on the planet an atomic bomb. And he asks rhetorically, you know, if you gave 6 billion people each their own atomic bomb, what are the odds that a few of them would go off in the hands of some nut? And he views it as incontrovertible that the answer is that, of course, something like this would happen. And so he is deeply concerned about the future of the planet. And there are other people like him, including, as you point out, Frank Fukuyama and the President's Commission for Bioethics, Leon Kass. Now, I'm a little bit more sanguine about the Frank Fukuyamas and the Leon Kasses of this world than some people, because I think they're asking some pretty good questions about what it means to be human. I mean, my view is that I wish that we'd had somebody raising these important questions when we were first sold nuclear power. I mean, I think if people were asking all of these questions when we first were being sold nuclear power, everybody would be better off, including the electric companies, who also were sold a bill of goods. So I think they're doing the world some service in asking these questions. Now, their answers are highly controversial, and I'm not necessarily endorsing those, but I'm glad to see people taking this seriously, and that's one of the things that Frank Fukuyama has done, is that he's a certifiably serious, deeply serious policy guy in Washington, and so he's forcing the pinstripe suit people to start taking the idea of transhumanism seriously and posthumanism, and that's really a first. he kind of blazed the trail for some of the rest of us, and so in that way, he's by causing them to start to take this seriously, he's done us all a favor.
I'm speaking with Joel Garreau. He's the author of Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. Joel, we've got a couple more minutes, so tell us now, the third scenario that you outline is the prevail scenario. It's the muddle-through scenario that avoids these extremes of millenarianism and apocalypticism. So what are the key elements? What are the signs that we might be entering prevail instead of apocalypse or millennium?
Well, the prevail scenario is profoundly different from both the heaven and hell scenario in that it doesn't think that human culture and values is necessarily inextricably tied to this curve of technological change. It doesn't see any smooth curves to human history. It propounds that history as we've known it has been a series of hiccups and reverses and loops and stops, and that that's unlikely to change. Now, because it doesn't have these nice, smooth mathematical curves, in some way it's the hardest case to make because you can't just kind of mathematically lay it out. But you can see its echoes in history. A prevail scenario was the British people, the nation of shopkeepers, standing up to the Third Reich and defeating Hitler. You know, that wasn't supposed to happen. All of the forces of the history were arrayed against them, and yet they prevailed. Huckleberry Finn is another one of my favorite examples. Huck was like, you know, everything in society and religion told him to turn in Jim, the guy that he sailed down the raft of the Mississippi with, and yet he stood up against all of the prevailing, you know, all of the forces, and he said, "Nope, I don't care. I'm going to do it my way." And I think that that's a profoundly human instinct, is to throw the curve a curve. My poster child for the prevail scenario is Jaron Lanier, who's one of the founders of virtual reality and another heavy-duty technologist. And he says, where these heaven and hell guys go wrong is that the way they measure change is by how many transistors you can fit on the head of a pin. He says, and that's a profoundly anti-humane version of viewing progress. It's not about technology, and it's not about individuals. To Jaron, the benchmark of the prevail scenario will be how many humans we can connect up. He's looking for a metric that involves the human spirit and the human will to go on, and he's much more interested in connecting humans than in connecting up technology, and that's his measure of how we will prevail, and that's the one that is not technological determinism. It's about cultural determinism, if anything. It's about human determinism. And that's why if I, you know, peel away my veneer of journalistic objectivity, in some ways I'm kind of pulling for prevail.
So what are the signs that we might be doing prevail as an historical project instead of these other two up and down scenarios?
Well, the big difference with prevail is that you'll see humans beginning to control their own future. It won't be technology in charge. It'll be humans in charge. If you start seeing bottom-up solutions, kind of like coevolution, for example, back in the 1500s and the 1600s, they had all sorts of intractable problems that they were facing, and suddenly the printing press came, and that allowed us to co-evolve new solutions like democracy and world trade and all sorts of brand new innovations that allowed solutions to problems that were beyond the scope of any one person or any one nation. And that's going to be the big question for us, is do we see co-evolution occurring? Do we see new solutions? It's child's play to say that we're looking at an increase in problems. The critical question is, are we seeing an increase in solutions, especially from hundreds of millions of people who are newly connected in ways that weren't possible even a generation before, who are coming up with brand new solutions that we could have never imagined? I mean, some of the hopeful signs are as pedestrian as eBay. You know, if you'd looked at military technology in the 1980s, you would be forgiven if you didn't expect to see the world's largest flea market suddenly growing up in a fashion such that people are coordinating their activities, you know, without the benefit of governments and without even the benefit of any kind of Wall Street kind of an arrangement. It's basically peer-to-peer. And the question is that's the thing to look at is for new ways of coming together, like swarming with cell phones, for example. You're beginning to see dictators having a harder and harder time holding on to power because all of a sudden people are empowered by their cell phones and can launch demonstrations on 30 minutes' notice, and it's almost impossible for a totalitarian government to block it. If you see those kind of increases in the way people are coming together to solve problems in novel ways that are not bound by technology, although they might be enabled by it, that might be a sign of the prevail scenario coming to fruit.
So in terms of the politics, you expect this to be decentralist and grassroots, but also very democratic and populist.
I'm a pragmatist. I don't have any particular ideology in this regard. I'm just curious as to what works. I observe that an awful lot of the top-down kind of command decision ways of doing things are just too slow if we're looking at, you know, an increased pace of change. I mean, I'm not against top-down solutions per se. I just don't think they move fast enough. That's why I'm interested in the bottom-up, because I just think it's more nimble. Is there a role for government? I'm not ideologically opposed to it the way some libertarians are. I'm just saying, you know, I'm in favor of what works. And so, I'm interested in, for example, the European model. Will that work, in which you have, people who are attempting to come to grips with genetically modified organisms, through their governments and through their own grassroots organizations? I don't have a clue. I don't have the most remote idea whether that's going to work, but I'm glad somebody's trying it, because I think the way that we're going to get into the future is by having as many solutions as we possibly can be created and see what works.
One of the folks that we're both fans of is the World Changing blog, and they're very concerned about trying to develop appropriate technologies for the developing world.
Certainly. I mean, one thing you can see is, you know, the cell phones entering the third world, and it's occurring much faster than earlier technologies did, like automobiles or refrigeration or electricity. And it's because of the curve constantly dropping the price. Organ transplants never became cheap because spare organs never became cheap. Cell phones, on the other hand, are just becoming ubiquitous throughout the third world because they're becoming dirt cheap. And a lot of these other technologies that are following the curve of exponential change will become equally available much, much faster than previous ones.
I've been speaking with Joel Garreau. He's the author of Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. It comes out next week from Doubleday. Thanks so much for joining us, Joel.
Thank you, Jay.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com, or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.